for people overseas, it's very hard to sort truth from fiction, imagination from reality when President Trump speaks. He may want to cultivate a positive image for the United States, but what he does, unfortunately, is demonstrate that he's reckless, he's impulsive, and he's quite capable of taking action that is devastating on the world stage. That's all he did in that speech. You know, we've got these marvelous flying wings. They can show up in the middle of the night anywhere in the world and destroy everything beneath them. Well, at the moment, he's gotten away with that. Is that the future? I don't think so. And do we want that as a future? Because, you know, somebody said many years ago, cast your bread upon the waters, and in a few days it will return many fold unto you. I think he's on a dangerous path. I think the world is increasingly sick of us. And that's how you get BRICS. That's how you get parallel financial institutions. That's why we're in a lot of trouble right now, because we are financially fragile and economically weak. And the world is beginning to figure it out. It's only a matter of time until this military hammer that he's talking about is exposed for what it is. It's an instrument, but it is by no means without countermeasures.
Yeah, we don't ever want to talk about that. More on that in a minute. I want to stick on this issue with Iran, though, right now. Let's just kind of pepper you with some questions here. Let's just say that is in the planning, and that we're going to take some military action against Iran. To start off here, what would such an attack look like? What do you think that, given our capabilities and assets in the region, along with Israel, given what happened last time, what would an attack look like, and what would be the end state?
Well, you know, everybody wants to delve into this, and this is really very dangerous. So I'm going to talk in broad terms because I happen to know a great deal about this, and the world does not need to know. I don't want to see Americans being sent in harm's way who are going to be exposed to dangerous enemy countermeasures. So let's keep this general. First of all, it's overwhelmingly and must be of necessity air and naval power. We are not going to commit ground forces to the invasion of Iran. It's just not going to happen. We don't have the ground forces to send. They're already overstretched. Most of them are in Europe. So that's not going to happen. Secondly, it's not so much what we will do. I think that's important, because what we'll do is similar to what you've seen in the past. We'll fly intercontinental bombers into the area. We'll try to bomb with impunity. We'll try to hit targets on the ground that we think are not adequately protected. We will refuel and resupply and support the Israelis who try to do the same thing from the air. This is not going to be altogether different. What we don't know is where some of these attacks will come from. Is Azerbaijan still a usable platform, or have the Russians made it clear to the Azeri Republic that this is unacceptable and they're not going to tolerate it? Where are the Russians now in all of this? What are they prepared to do? How many of them are already on the ground in Iran working on this integrated air defenses? What about the rest of the region? Will the rest of the region sit idly by and let us violate their airspace as they have in the past? What happens in Egypt? The Egyptians are building up, and the Egyptians could intervene militarily. And right now, the Israelis on the ground are probably weaker than they've been in a very long time. They've taken heavy casualties. The country is fatigued. Reservists are not showing up. There are a lot of things that could happen, and they could happen very suddenly. We don't have the luxury of doing anything we want. We are going to be limited in how we attack from the directions we attack, how far we penetrate, and what we use. So I think President Trump would do us all a favor by talking a lot less about it. But, you know, beyond that, I don't think we should say very much. Let's just assume it's all air and naval. And people like the air and naval power in Washington, because they don't see it as putting much at risk. In other words, they think that they can continue to strike and bomb with impunity, with no probability of high losses. I'm not sure that's true, but we'll see, because no doubt that's what we're going to see again.
And let's look at the other half of that equation. What would Iran do in response? So the claim was made after the 12-day war was that the Israel and the United States destroyed most of what was left of their air defense systems. And so now then everything's really vulnerable and they could go in and clean up. But then I've seen other reports, which I cannot validate, that says that they have actually been rebuilding both their missiles, their strike missile force, and expanding their inventory, as well as with the Russians' help, expanding or rebuilding their air defense. Do you have any expect or understanding of how that situation is developing?
You know, if I were to guess, based upon the limited material I've seen, if we say integrated air defenses are at 100%, if everything is perfect, I would say they're probably 60 to 70% of what they need to be. Now, that's 50% better than we saw before, okay? So if I say that they're 60 to 70% of what ideally they would like to have, that's an exceptionally better than what was encountered the last time around. And frankly, some of those air defenses were destroyed. Some of them were never really tested. Most of the munitions and rockets, missiles and so forth were fired beyond the range of the integrated air defenses. That's going to be tougher right now because our missile inventory is down. We don't have as many missiles as we had the last time. We are going to rely more, I suspect, on precision gravity bombs, which means that you have to fly through the integrated air defenses to deliver those bombs. We'll see. That's just a general observation based on the numbers I've seen presented to me of the available missiles and munitions. And we've talked before, Dan, about the inventory. Our inventory is down, and we can't rapidly surge and build more missiles. The Israelis, of course, now have a good stockpile of the theater high-altitude air defense missiles, the THAAD, the radars. They've got the equivalent of two batteries. I suspect we've stripped out a lot from the other batteries to bring them up to full strength, and our soldiers are operating those on the ground in Israel. I'd be very surprised if those were not targets early on in any response the Iranians launch against the Israelis. In other words, they'll go after those batteries. There's no doubt about it. And something like the Oreshnik, if they have something like that, and they do have hypersonic missiles, will annihilate all of that in a few seconds. The bottom line is that this is a very dangerous thing for Israel. Israel could be on the receiving end of something twice or three times worse than what they saw the last time. The danger for Iran is very clear, that as the Israelis begin to lose, if we're not able to reduce the damage, that the Israelis will simply opt for a nuclear weapon. I think that the Israelis, once again, are going to be focused on the regime. They think that if they can just remove this regime, the country will begin to fall apart. They don't seem to have figured out that the opposite is the case. And right now, in both human terms as well as in equipment terms, the Iranians have built a lot of redundancy. So they made it very clear. Actually, the president of Iran has made it clear. If I die, there are others who are going to step up and take over and execute the mission. So I don't think they've come to terms with the reality that Iran is not some sort of tribalized state in the Arabian Peninsula. This is a modern nation state now with a lot of capability, and it now has the support of its people on a scale that I don't think it's had in decades. So the notion of an invasion from Azerbaijan to raise a rebellion of Azeri Turks against the government is pure fantasy. It's not going to happen. But I think the Israelis have a great deal of difficulty coming to terms with reality. They just don't like it, and they don't believe it. If they believed it, I think we would be dealing with a different group of people in Israel. They're not rational at this point.
Well, and speaking of that, if Israel, since Israel actually has a nuclear inventory, and it's the worst kept secret than anyone, everybody is aware that that's the reality here. Given that Iran probably doesn't have any nuclear weapons, why can't Israel just say our security is completely insured, and we can tell them if they ever cross any, you can fill in the red lines that you want to, then we'll use the nuclear weapons, and if you don't, everything's going to be fine. That they would then be secure. Why this compulsion to either destroy or turn off or have a regime change? What do you think the compulsion is that? I don't understand the logic.
Well, I think the compulsion is important to understand. It's sort of extending your frontiers of insecurity well beyond what is reality or necessary. mean, we can go back through history and look at many states that have engaged in this sort of thing. Why did Bonaparte feel compelled to invade Russia? There was no real reason to do so. And had he stayed out of it, he could probably have stayed in charge of most of Europe for the balance of his lifetime. If you turn to the Second World War, setting aside the first, where the Germans made it very clear they were not going to invade Russia, and they let the Russians impale themselves on German defenses that ran from Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, down through Poland, all the way around Hungary and in Western Ukraine. They were smarter than that. They let the Russians do the attacking, and they took the heavy losses. In World War II, though, they decided to march into this place with the goal of regime change. What a dumb idea. Anybody who'd looked at that rationally, had even an ounce of common sense, would have said no, but this romanticism took over. And I think there's a lot of romanticism in that sense in the Israeli mind. They really think they're on the verge of dominating everything. I mean, imagine the president of the United States being in a foreign country and announcing that he now controls TikTok, and everyone in the world is going to be subjected to a steady dose of pro-American propaganda and information from our control of TikTok. People would look at him and they say, well, what's wrong with this man? Is he crazy? If we don't all just watch TikTok. I mean, we do have brains. We can think. There are alternatives. But that's what Netanyahu has done. He's now extolling the virtues of Israeli control over TikTok. And as a result, he thinks he's won a critical battle in the great war for control of the United States and the Western world. It's a dumb idea. People aren't that stupid. But apparently, he seems to think they are. Why would you announce such a thing? If you wanted it to be effective, you would probably pretend that it was objective, right? But this is unbridled arrogance, for which that particular group of people in Israel are well known. And arrogance is always the next to last chapter in the history of the state that engages in it. We've seen that before. You know, during the war, several times German generals did actually tell Hitler, you know, that's too much. It can't work. And he would look at them and he'd say, you don't know what you're talking about. I know. The German soldier can do anything. No. No soldier in any country can do anything. That's nonsense. So that, I think that's where Netanyahu is now. Only instead of soldiers, I think he's talking more about a commanding lead in aerospace technology and missiles and the absolute, total, and complete unconditional support of the United States Armed Forces.
Well, we'll have to see how that's going to play out, and we'll keep monitoring that. But you mentioned this kind of delusionary thinking, which we've been talking about in terms of what's going on in the Middle East. Unfortunately, that illness or that sickness extends into other areas, and we're going to take a look at what's going on in the Russia-Ukraine war, because there's another example there. And we're going to start off with Volodymyr Zelensky, who, on the one hand, is complaining about all these attacks on his energy infrastructure.
Russia has rejected every proposal to end the war or even to halt the strikes. It's blatantly trying to destroy our civilian infrastructure, especially now ahead of winter. Gas facilities, power plants, and transmission systems. Zero real reaction from the world.
So he's actually mad at the world because they're not standing up and I guess coming to his aid and fighting, oblivious to everything that's happened in the last 3.5 years. But what do you make of his focus right in here that how dare the Russians do this? And they haven't paid any attention and done anything for peace. Is that accurate?
Well, look, anything that comes out of the man's mouth is a bold-faced lie. But the issue of energy is a very important one. Energy is the key to everything. You can make a pretty damn good argument that the Second World War waged by Germany was lost largely because it didn't have the energy to sustain itself and keep things running. If you look at the strikes right now, just they're terrible and they're doing enormous damage to the energy infrastructure. But I received some information this morning that was sent to me from friends abroad. It was translated from the Russian. And the Russians have internally said all of Russia's oil and gas is now completely diverted away from Europe. In other words, most all of it is going through Central Asia into China and down into India. And there is no plan nor any interest in the infrastructure that exists in the West in terms of restarting the energy to Europe. So as far as they're concerned, they've made their decision. They've reoriented all of their energy to Asia and Central Asia and Southwest Asia. In other words, it doesn't make any difference what we say or do anymore. They're not playing. They're not coming back. I think that's the most serious consequence of this Ukraine catastrophe. It's not that the energy infrastructure in Ukraine is being destroyed. That's the sort of thing you do when you're finishing off your enemy once and for all. That's what we did during World War II to the Germans. We reduced them to the point where no German aircraft in June, July of 1944 could stay in the air for more than a couple of hours because they just didn't have the fuel to move them. You know, they were making fuel out of potatoes, believe it or not, in order to move armored divisions. So my point is that the Russians are finishing off the Ukrainians, put it bluntly. But it's not just the Ukrainians. They are saying, that's it. Our history with Europe is at an end. No more from us. And that's a very tough thing, because if you live in Finland and Sweden and Germany and Poland and Hungary, now they're going to try and supply the Hungarians and I'm sure the Slovaks, but the rest of us are out. We've had it. This is catastrophic, because when this stupidity ends, this pointless, unnecessary war ends, what has everybody got to do? They've got to rebuild. How are you going to rebuild without energy? You're going to import from us, and we're not cutting anybody any breaks on price. On the contrary, we're exploiting the opportunity and screwing our European allies to the wall, which in the mind of somebody like Trump, who thinks that's good business, is something to be celebrated.
Let me ask you this. Interpreting in light of what you just said and what it seems like that many in the West are stumbling into, how would you interpret this comment by General Jack Keane, who's viewing all these things that you're talking about, all this stuff with the energy infrastructure, the final settlement, at least some knowledge of history in World War II, et cetera. He's saying that not only should we not recognize that and seek a negotiated settlement, he's saying we need to slap Russia harder.
Putin is steady. He's deliberate. He's ruthless, to be sure, but he's not reckless. These are deliberate, methodical moves that he is making to undermine the United States' will and resolve and undermine the Europeans' will and resolve. That's what he is really about here. And we've got to stay focused on it. We've got to upgun the Ukrainians militarily. And some of those decisions have been made last week. And that's all good. We can't get into the specifics of that. And I still think we got to foreclose on the sanctions and the tariffs, slap them hard in terms of anybody that's purchasing oil, certainly from the Russians. That obviously is China. It's Iran. It's a whole bunch of other countries that are helping to finance this and arm them, for sure. But the reality is we have got to get tougher militarily and also economically to put real pressure on Russia.
I just don't understand with the wreckage of 3.5 years of failed military and economic policies, why do we still get people in positions like this saying, let's do more of that?
Yeah, it's difficult to explain. But I think there is a, you know, active denial of reality. Just look at what's happened with India. You know, India has been a friend to the United States. They've actually absorbed a lot of the missions that we used to perform in the Indian Ocean and in East Africa. They've gone after the pirates so that our sea power was freed up to do other things. We have had good relations with India. We don't do a lot of trade with them, but nevertheless, there's no reason to alienate the Indians, but that's exactly what we've done. Essentially, Modi has said, thank you very much. You want to punish us for buying oil and gas from Russia? We're going to continue to do that because it's vital to our national interest. You know, there's this old expression that Washington used repeatedly saying, no nation can be expected to move beyond the limits of its own interests. When you begin saying that you must now become hostile to Russia or we will take action against you, means that at least half the world is just going to walk away from you because they don't give a damn what you are trying to do to Russia. They're concerned with their own economic stability, their own energy needs. You know, they're not going to behave like the Germans and commit national suicide. So it's a rather stupid idea. It has no chance of success. The other thing is, militarily, what are you going to do? Are we going to round up the million men that we think are Ukrainian men that are living in Europe right now who refuse to go home? Now, there are many millions, but I'm talking about military eligible males, whether it's in Italy or Sweden or Germany or France or Poland. Are we now going to arrest them, put them on boxcars and ship them east so that they can be quickly equipped and trained and sent into the meat grinder to die in vast numbers? Or is he simply saying, we'll just provide more missiles and rockets that can be lobbed over the heads of the Russian army on the ground in eastern Ukraine and hit Russian cities? Well, if that's what he's advocating, we're going to be at war with Russia. And we don't have the manufacturing base that we did 80 years ago. We're not going to be able to gear up quickly for a war. We're not going to be able to keep up with the wastage and missiles and equipment that are necessary to fight a war. But the Russians can do it. The Russians are ready for it. And as you know, Dan, they're mobilizing additional manpower. They're fully prepared for the unfortunate tragedy that we decide to go to war with them. And then, of course, you have President Trump that seems to vacillate. Oh, yes, I'm going to send Tomahawk missiles, and that'll make a big difference. Then he talks to Putin on the phone. He says, well, maybe I won't do that. Maybe we need to tell the Ukrainians, well, or ask the Ukrainians, where are you going to shoot them? You know, come on, give me a break. This is all nonsense. It's irrational nonsense. It's a combination of arrogance and ignorance in the worst sense of the word. And there's a failure to understand that we and the Europeans are playing with fire. The Russians aren't going to stand around and allow us to humiliate them in perpetuity. It's ridiculous. So bottom line is that he's well paid. He's one of your Fox News influencers, just like the influencers that our friend Bibi Netanyahu has purchased in the United States, who are being paid as much as $7,000 a post for something that advocates support for Israel against the Palestinians in Gaza or anywhere else. He's in the same boat. He picks up his check, and his bank account is flush with millions in cash because he comes on and says these things. And it's not only the Israelis. I mean, if anybody has looked at the defense industries, they certainly have profited enormously from these wars and want to continue to do so. So there are people all over Washington, all over the United States, who are willing to throw money at someone like Jack Keane, because when he speaks, they introduce him as a general, four-star general. If a four-star general says it, it's got to be right. Wrong. I mean, we went through this in Vietnam. And let me tell you, William Westmoreland was a much better human being and a much better officer than many people give him credit for being. But he was wrong. And he was saying things that were outrageous, only I think he actually believed them. I don't think that's the case right now. I think you're either on one team or the other. And that means you're with the Uniparty and everything the Uniparty wants to do, or you're out. You're edged out. You go to the land of Charlie Kirk and vanish.